You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Glenn Frankel returns to the show this week. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer whose books include The Searchers, The Making of an American Legend, and High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic. His latest book is Shooting Midnight Cowboy, Art, Sex, Loneliness, Liberation, and the Making of a Dark Classic. Glenn Frankel, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me, Gary.
So your previous books about movies that I loved so much, one was High Noon, the great Gary Cooper Western, and The Searchers, the great John Wayne Western. Were you aware that Midnight Cowboy is not a Western?
Yeah, I had a pretty good idea about that. In fact, I saw Midnight Cowboy when it first came out in 1969. And I noticed the cowboy outfit on Joe Buck, the main character. But yes, I was well aware that
you did know. Okay, I was just making sure. Of course, they do reference John Wayne. It's kind of interesting that they reference John Wayne in Midnight Cowboy, and then John Wayne beat them for the Academy Award that year.
Yeah, no, John Wayne is there. You'll notice Paul Newman on the wall in the movie HUD on a movie poster. And in the novel, though not, he didn't make the cut for the movie, there's a little moment where they discuss Gary Cooper.
Oh.
So we're all in the same ballpark, I guess you could say. But honestly, I wasn't thinking of this as the third of a cowboy trilogy or anything.
Well, then let me ask you, in the New Yorker piece about your book, which was really nice, they mentioned that Midnight Cowboy is kind of a neglected film in the film history. And what was that your motivation for writing about Midnight Cowboy?
Well, this certainly was one of the reasons. I mean, frankly, when you go out there looking for a movie to spend a whole book on, you're looking for something that hasn't been overdone. Or and I was surprised to find, for example, with Searchers, there had never been, other than a lovely little British Film Institute book, you know, a book really devoted to the movie. And that's also the case with Midnight Cowboy. So, yes, I felt it had been a little bit overlooked in the pantheon of the great, you know, new Hollywood movies of the late 60s and early 70s. I also love the fact that it was, you know, filmed and came out in the late 60s, which is a very rich time in both movie history and in American history. So I was looking for something different. And frankly, I was looking for something a little more adult and a little more contemporary. It's still a 50-year-old movie, but it has a lot of resonance, I think, in our time as well. So for all those reasons, I just kind of merrily stumbled into it and found out it was actually much richer and more complex and more barrier-breaking, I would argue, as a film than the other ones I'd been writing about.
Well, you do in both of your other books that I and you've written other books, I know, but in your film books, the thing that I loved about The Searchers was that you uncovered that it was a movie about racism, and it was presented to an audience for whom racism was so endemic that they didn't realize they were seeing a movie about racism. And yeah. That High Noon was a parable for the Blacklist, and the average moviegoer had no idea there was a Blacklist. So what were some of the things that you found in this movie that you wanted to talk about?
Well, I guess the first thing to say is that in all these books, I'm telling the story of the making of a great movie, but I'm also trying to tell the story of the era the movie was made in. I think movies are a great looking glass into history. You know, you can read newspapers, you can read history books, all kinds of things, but there's nothing like a good movie in a way to put you directly back in the context of the times, whether it means to or not. You learn so much, and Midnight Cowboy definitely fits in that category. I mean, one of the things by a story set mostly in New York in the 1960s, one of the things that surprised me, I suppose, and that I thought was most interesting was attitudes about homosexuality in that era, and how Midnight Cowboy, while it wasn't in itself, it was breaking new ground in its depiction of gay people, of having gay sex as well as, you know, straight sex involved in it. Those things and its attitudes about that were something new. And it took me right back to that era, which is a, you know, It's the dawn of gay liberation. In fact, the Stonewall riots occur 1 month after the premiere of Midnight Cowboy in 1969. But we're still in a time before homosexuality is recognized, say, by the American Psychiatric Association as not necessarily a mental illness that in and of itself. We're in an era when it still is considered not only a mental illness, but a contagious disease by in conventional wisdom. And that had all kinds of ramifications on the way it was looked at and how gay people were looked at, because after all, if they were diseased and if there was a cure, then they needed to be cured. And if they didn't get cured, then they were perverts. There was something, you know, ill about them. All of that was still going on. And you see some of that reflected. You see a lot of it reflected in the way Hollywood treated homosexuality throughout the 60s. Midnight Cowboy is an exception to that in many ways. And so in that sense, it's a breakthrough movie in a lot of other ways, in its treatment of sexuality in general, and in its focus on these sort of social outcasts. You know, Joe Buck, this lonely, solitary figure coming up from Texas to New York, thinking he's going to become a male hustler. But he's really one of God's solitary, lonely men. You know, his life has been one of being abandoned by his mother and mistreated by his grandmother. His sexuality is ambiguous, and he's subject of a rape. All these things are happening to him, and he ends up homeless and on the street in New York. And Ratso Rizzo, the one person he ends up finding some sort of wary partnership with, is also, you know, an outcast, a sort of third-rate con man, disabled, very ill, you know, from the Bronx. So those kinds of characters had not appeared often, if ever, in mainstream American movies. So just in those two kinds of ways, that we're in different territory, and that made it a much richer experience for me.
It's and as you talk about the era in which the film was made, it was the era in which the production code for the first time had disappeared and was replaced by a rating system that allowed for a movie to be made by adults for an adult audience rather than for a general audience. The rating was very important.
That I think that's very important. And it gets into the whole subject of what's happening to Hollywood in this time and to popular culture in general. I mean, we're seeing lots of breakthrough moments, both, you know, in literature with Portnoy's Complaint and, you know, in Myra Breckinridge by Gore Vidal. These kinds of things are happening there. They're happening in the theater with The Boys in the Band, which is really the first mainstream play, you know, off-Broadway play about homosexuality. You know, so popular culture is exploding and Hollywood is trying to catch up to some of this. Hollywood's always behind. But that was even more apparent in the late 60s. And you're absolutely right. The so-called production code, the old self-censorship system, was scrapped around that time. I mean, Hollywood was losing audience. It had been losing audience ever since after World War II, but especially in the 60s, the old genres, you know, the movie musicals and the, you know, Doris Day rom-coms and the Westerns, for that matter, we're not getting much traction with people of our generation, of, you know, the so-called baby boomers, who were going to be the next big paying audience for movies. And yet Hollywood didn't have any notion of how to reach them with the old genres or with the old stars, for that matter. And this starts to become interesting around 67 when The Graduate is made and Bonnie and Clyde, and these kinds of movies are incredibly successful with younger audiences. And so the studio moguls are looking to catch up, and they scrap the old code and they put in the rating system exactly to create opportunities for different kinds of movies. But they don't know exactly what works and what doesn't. 69 is also the year of Easy Rider, a movie that costs, what, I think about $600,000 to shoot and makes $60 million at the box office.
Right.
So Hollywood pays attention to things that are successful, and they're out there looking to spend not a lot of money, but some money to do things that are unconventional. I you couldn't have made Midnight Cowboy 5 years earlier. Never.
Or
would
5 years later. Or maybe 10. Well, you certainly couldn't make it now.
I don't think so. That's a longer discussion. I mean, you could make some version of it now, but for sure, you know, under the production code, you couldn't even show a man and woman, a husband and wife in bed together, let alone having sex.
Right.
So here we come. Things are changing. The walls are coming down all over popular culture, and movies are following suit.
I was watching a movie the other night. It was called Fever in the Blood. It was made in 1961, and it had Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. in it and Angie Dickinson.
Oh.
And the movie begins with a woman in her bedroom, and a man pushes his way into her bedroom, grabs her, and smothers her with a pillow. That was completely okay. That you could show.
Right. You can kill Angie Dickinson, but you can't sleep with her.
That's right. Go ahead and murder. But that's
a whole, you know, wrong reversal of, of values. Honestly.
This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we're talking today with Glenn Frankel. He's the author of a new book called Shooting Midnight Cowboy: Art, Sex, Loneliness, Liberation, and the Making of a Dark Classic.
In 1969, there was another movie. Well, you mentioned that that in your book that Easy Rider doesn't particularly hold up very well, which it doesn't. It's kind of hard to watch now. But it is about the relationship of a bunch of guys hanging out together. And that same year was Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which is about two men that love each other, although there's a woman involved, but mostly it's about these two guys. And I think one of the key moments in Midnight Cowboy, and it only lasts a fraction of a second, which is a tribute to the concise filmmaking in Midnight Cowboy. But after Joe Buck has been cheated by Ratso, and he's looking for him, he wants to kill him, and then he forgets about that. He's so lonely and miserable, and he spills ketchup on himself and all those other things that happen. He sees Ratso in a diner, and for a fraction of a second, you see him lighten up, like his face just brightens up, like, oh, it's my friend. Then he remembers he wants to kill him. But just for that one second, I think it's really key. It's really a movie about, it's a buddy picture about these two guys that happen to live in the sleaziest possible environment.
Well, I agree with you up to a point. Yeah, that's a really good perception, and I haven't, one that I hadn't really thought much about. He's so lonely, and he's in New York. And remember, he comes to New York with a couple hundred bucks in his wallet, and various New Yorkers take turns stripping him of 20s, including Ratso, conning him or getting money out of him or refusing to deliver on things. So he's out of money. He's got nothing in his wallet. And there is this guy, and he he's already just agreed to have sex with a young kid who's going to give him supposedly 25 bucks. And then the kid doesn't have the money, so he's down to his last dime, literally. And you're right. He sees him. But I think it's not a buddy movie like Butch Cassidy, in the sense that these guys very, very slowly develop a certain détente. But they never really, they're constantly picking at each other. Joe is threatening Ratso. Remember, at one point, Ratso says, "I get it, you're a killer," with that sardonic look in Dustin Hoffman's face. And it's a wonderful moment, too. But, at the critical point, the other critical moment, I would say, that reveals us toward the end of the movie is after Joe Buck has found a woman to have sex with who gives him $20, a socialite played by Brenda Vaccaro. And he comes back to this, dirty tenement squat where he and Ratso have been living heatless, and winter's coming on. And he's very happy. And Ratso tells him, that he can't walk anymore. Joe doesn't want to stay with him. Joe tries to take him, call an ambulance, get something, get this guy out of there. Joe doesn't want to be responsible for Ratso. And only when Ratso refuses to go along with any of that does Joe sort of recognize he has no choice, that he has to protect this guy. And even as he's going out the door to go get the money to take this guy to Florida and try to save his life, you can hear in the dialogue him saying, "Just when I finally get free, just when I finally get somewhere, you stop me, you need this and that." And he storms his way out. So maybe it's love, hate. I don't know how you would describe it exactly, but it ain't, it ain't Butch Cassidy. And I love Butch Cassidy. And I think Redford is a comic. Paul Newman's a wonderful comic actor, but Redford is way underrated because he's terrific.
Yeah.
you know, and puncturing Butch Cassidy's balloons all through that movie. Nonetheless, I think what's happening with Joe and Ratso is on a different level than that.
It obviously is, but at the same time, it does have those elements. In fact, I was thinking of Laurel and Hardy. You know, Laurel and Hardy are, in every picture they ever made, they play Laurel and Hardy, and sometimes they share a bed. One comedy, they even adopt a baby together. and they dance with each other, just the way Ratso and Joe Buck dance to keep warm in one of the scenes in Midnight Cowboy. And, you know, there's never any hint of homosexuality between Stan and Ollie, but it's like a marriage. And in that way, in your book, you talk about this scene where Ratso is cooking for Joe Buck, and they have a husband and wife kind of relationship as well.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It is like a marriage, and it's a very wary marriage of two loners, two people who have never relied on anyone, and yet two very vulnerable people who are really desperate at this point. You know, Ratso's life is at stake here, and Joe is not making it at all. And so these guys have to bond in the end because they've got nobody else. I think that's the core of the movie, and John Schlesinger, the director, felt it was too. He rejects some of the early screenplays for it because the screenplay writer didn't capture the essence of that, didn't understand that was what the movie was really about. And I also think it's the reason why we still watch the movie, many of us, because that human connection, as fraught as it was, is something that's enduring and that, you know, we can all relate to, whether it's 1969 or, you know, 2021.
I was surprised in your book and kind of delighted when Dustin Hoffman was unhappy with the final cut of the film. And I think that's because Schlesinger really focused in on what the movie was about and understood it better than Dustin Hoffman did.
Yeah, Dustin Hoffman was really enthusiastic about being in the movie because it gave him a chance to play a character and to do something very different than he'd done in The Graduate. I mean, he loved his new fame in the sense that, you know, he was getting attention and he was going to make a lot more money for movies and plays. And he wanted to show people that he wasn't just Benjamin Braddock, you know, this little white bread guy. And so Midnight Cowboy gave him that, and he was delighted to be in it, but he didn't recognize all of the implications of being in that movie. I make fun of him, I'm afraid, by saying he didn't realize the name of the movie was Midnight Cowboy, not Midnight Ratso. And so when it's all done, he looks at it and he realizes he doesn't come in until the 25th minute of the movie. And, you know, and some of the little business that he does in the movie was cut inevitably. And John Voight's in every scene in the movie. But the thing that really got him was when he went to a couple of the previews, he noticed that around the time of the scene between Voight and Bob Balaban playing this young kid who's supposedly going to pay Joe for having sex in the balcony of the sleazy, you know, 42nd Street movie theater, that people were walking out of the preview that Dustin saw. And then the movie got rated X, and he didn't know the backstory of that. He just saw it was rated X. People are walking out at this gay scene, and he was afraid, you know, it was going to be considered some kind of porno movie and was going to wreck his beautiful new career. So for all those reasons, he takes a hike for a while. Later, when it does so well at the box office and when it gets nominated for 70 Academy Awards, including him for Best Actor, he comes back and he recognizes today, absolutely recognizes that it's one of the great films in his body of work, as does John Voight, of course.
His ego got in the way there for 10 minutes.
Yeah, well, you know, he's trying to build a career. And remember, he'd spent 10 years struggling in New York, trying to just get a foothold. And finally, he breaks through, and now he's afraid. The other thing he goes out of course is he agrees to be in a little movie called John and Mary. I don't know if you've ever seen that one, Gary.
Mia Farrow, yes.
Yeah, I saw it when it came out. It's not very memorable, put it that way. But that's Dustin trying to course correct.
After Midnight Cowboy. No, I mean, I rushed to see it at the time because I always wanted to see a Dustin Hoffman movie.
Well, and, exactly.
Yeah. And in fact, I saw Midnight Cowboy when it was released, even though I was, I think, 14 when it came out. And my mom took me to the theater and spoke to the theater manager and said, it's all right, I want my son to see the movie, because I was a movie file even then. And I loved the movie and I was moved by the movie. And when I watched the movie again 10 years later or something, I realized how much I didn't understand, that it really isn't a movie for someone who's 14. I mean, there's so much in it that a 14-year-old could enjoy in terms of the relationships and the humor and I'm walking here and all that. But there's also some stuff that's baffling to kids. Yeah.
Yes.
So I think the X rating was the perfect rating for that picture, actually.
Well, it's interesting you say that. John Schlesinger, the director, and Jerry Hellman, his producer, always made that claim as well, that they didn't mind the X rating because it was an adult movie and it was made for adults. But lurking back there, of course, behind that is the question of homosexuality. It was originally rated R by the ratings board itself, the new ratings board, which recognized its qualities and said, well, if some adult wants to take their 16 or 17-year-old to see it, fine. I don't know about 14. That wasn't an art in the
law. I was sophisticated.
Yeah. Your mom, well, let's say your mom was a very liberal person and you know, but they, Arthur Krim, the head of United Artists, who loved the film, nonetheless was queasy about the sex in the film and specifically the gay sex in the film in a way. And so like any good liberal, you know, a modern person in that era, he goes and consults with the psychiatrist, a distinguished psychiatrist, who says, no, you're absolutely right. You know, parroting the sort of conventional wisdom of the time, the psychiatrist says, I think this movie would badly affect a young man like you, Gary, or like me at 19, you know, and it could cause, you know, someone to become gay, you know, because we're looking at a contagious disease here, like COVID or something. And so it's Arthur Krim who rates it X. He doesn't tell anybody he's doing that. And people assume it's the ratings board, but it's actually Krim. And so I think you can make the case for rating it X because of the adult nature of it, but specifically it was rated X because of the gay depiction.
And I think modern audiences, when they hear that the movie is rated X or that it had been rated X, they're confused because triple X became the rating for pornography. And at no time was Midnight Cowboy considered pornographic at the time of its release. And I think the same can be said of Last Tango in Paris, which came out a couple of years later.
Yeah.
That movie, the X rating was the perfect rating for that film as well. It's a very sophisticated and interesting drama. And it's not, there's nothing purient in any of the nudity or sex in either of those films. And there's way more in, you know, in the average episode of some TV show that they have now on HBO or Showtime or something. It's interesting how our standards have changed over the years. Now I think Midnight Cowboy would be rated PG-13. I mean, there's virtually no nudity in it.
No, there's next to no nudity, just a little snippet here or there, but there's a gang rape, though that's occurring in a flash cut and it's a little hard to figure out what's going on. All of the sex in Midnight Cowboy is rather cold and transactional. There's no romantic sex in the movie. So yes, it's just a very mature movie and takes a really tough view. The scene where Joe, toward the end of the movie, where he beats up a customer to get the money again to take Ratso down is a very raw scene. And I think, I know, you know, Hollywood doesn't rate anything based on violence, it seems like.
Right, sure.
But that kind of moment, you know, I could make the case for a good R anyway.
Very few movies that I can think of portray violence in the way that film does. I mean, another film that from that same era would be Frenzy by Alfred Hitchcock. Usually violence is stylized in the movies, like this movie that I mentioned where the guy smothers his woman with a pillow. You know, it's usually bloodless, or it's staged, or it's overly bloody. That was a thing that was happening in the, you know, Bonnie and Clyde era. But both of those depictions, the one where he, where Bernard Hughes gets smashed with the telephone, and the murder scene in Frenzy, those are so real that they're very disturbing now. And I imagine they were disturbing then.
Yeah, and it's one of those moments where, you know, Schlesinger shows his adherence to a certain ethic. He felt it had to be in there. A lot of people didn't want it in there. It's in the novel, incidentally. But he just, you know, but people were saying, well, it will make Joe so unsympathetic, you know, that it'll damage the identification with him. And maybe it does. Maybe it does in some ways. I mean, that cowboy is not long on redemption. You know, it's you don't know what's going to happen to Joe after, you know, after he gets off the bus in Florida. You don't know if things are going to work out for him at all. And that's I think Schlesinger and his screenwriter Waldo Salt, who also insisted that it had to stay, you know, being true to their vision of what this really was about and the damage that had been done to Joe both over the years, but in his time in New York, you know, how it had hardened him. And yet at the same time, why does he do this terrible deed? He does it to try to get the money, to take his friend, to try to save his friend's life.
So, and the frustration, I think, that he's feeling is also a part of that violence, right? Because you were saying about how, here I'm finally, you know, he's very frustrated at that moment.
Yeah, you're right. All these things have come together, and it's real. I mean, it's Schlesinger trying to get at real human emotion and the conflicts, you know, that exist within a person to try to break through and at the same time to be loyal to someone. I mean, it's an adult movie. Again, that's one of the reasons why I enjoyed so much doing it. It really breaks a lot of barriers for Hollywood at that time. And that's one of them.
Also, I was mentioning the sort of concise filmmaking, which it's really a textbook on that, and the flashbacks and all of those things. Whereas today they would, you know, today it would start with a 20-minute prologue or whatever. But that violent scene that we mentioned, I don't think it's longer than 4 seconds or something. And you mentioned how Bernard Hughes, the actor, who was a wonderful actor who I loved, yeah, played that part, that he got the idea of taking his teeth out, spitting his teeth out, which is just a very generous acting thing to do.
All of this, but it's not, you know, Voight and Hoffman are terrific in the movie, and we know that, and we see that, and we honor that even today. But all of the supporting cast are really quite wonderful also, including Bob Balaban in that sleazy moment in the balcony, the great Sylvia Miles, who's only on for 7 minutes as the aging hooker in the beginning, and yet she was nominated for, you know, Best Supporting Actress. You name them, and Barnard Hughes, everybody's good, and they all get their sort of individual playlets with Voight. You know, each little moment that Sylvia Miles and Voight together in her little penthouse thing, and then in the balcony with Balaban and Barnard Hughes. I think those kinds of qualities, and we owe that a lot to Marion Doherty, the great casting director who chose all these people and brought them in and brought them to Schlesinger and Hellman. But I think those things are really a little bit overlooked because they work so well. And yet they really are part of the things that make the movie so special.
And she has no credit on the screen in the film, the casting director.
That's right. Marion Doherty is another fascinating figure. And again, I loved telling her story because her story reveals a lot about how women were dealt with in that era. It's another part of the history of that era, the social history. Marion Doherty, you know, mostly had done TV casting till then. For many years, the studios all had their own casting directors, and they had all these people on contract to appear in movies. So they would just kind of, after deciding on the stars, they'd just have the casting director go out and whoever was on, you know, around the lot and didn't have anything to do, they'd bring them in to play the roles. But once the studios get rid of all those folks, the studios, you know, undergoing this change and losing money, well, you need to have someone who can cast. And on the West Coast, it's people like Lynn Stallmaster. And on the East Coast, it's Marion Doherty. And she knows every actor in New York, literally. And she's got an index card in pencil on every one of them. And all those cards are now, incidentally, at the Motion Picture Academy Library in Beverly.
Oh, wow.
They gave them all away. Marion, who I'd never heard of until I started working on this. She was independent. She was feisty. She wouldn't bring you 10, you know, actors to a director. She'd bring two or three different and of different physical, you know, characteristics. She really knew how, the art of casting, and both Voight and Hoffman owe her a great debt for having insisted on, you know, that Schlesinger look at them and take them seriously for these parts. We think of Voight and Hoffman now as, you know, what could be more natural
to do it right.
Nice. To use it, but that's not how it happened at the time. You know, it took a lot, especially to get Voight the role. So Marion does this, and it's one of the things that really struck me about this movie, and that I didn't know till I started digging into it, was how many extraordinarily talented people, gifted people, were involved in it, and this, and looked at it then and look at it now, the ones who are still with us, as really the height of their careers.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We're talking tonight with Glenn Frankel. He's the author of Shooting Midnight Cowboy, Art, Sex, Loneliness, Liberation, and the Making of a Dark Classic.
I was intrigued with the idea of Elvis Presley playing Joe Buck, because I know immediately people hear that and they go, oh my God, well, how that would be terrible. But, you know, those people, those among us who love the King and know his body of work, know that he really was a fine actor. And if you look at pictures like King Creole, directed by Michael Curtiz, for instance, you can see that, you know, if he had put his mind to something, that could have been a career changing moment for Elvis that might have prolonged his life. Who knows? I mean, I think that would have been a really interesting casting. Would have been a different picture, but.
Well, the Colonel, you have respect for Elvis's acting ability, and I do too, but the Colonel was never going to let Elvis
do that.
Anything like that. If they'd added music and they'd taken out all this sort of gay subcontext, you know, maybe it would have been a very, very different movie. So we can dream. It would have been, listen, they talked about Sammy Davis Jr. briefly for Ratso. I think Sammy Davis Jr. had, you know, had some
roles. He could have done that part.
I'd been able to pull some of that off, though I think the combination of those two guys would have been difficult.
Glenn Frankel, in your book, Shooting Midnight Cowboy, you talk about Jennifer Salt, the actress who played Annie, and who in the film, her character is raped.
And again, that rape scene lasts exactly 15th of a second. But apparently they took all day to shoot it, and she wasn't happy. Tell us a little bit about that.
And Jennifer was one of my most favorite interviews for this book because, well, we got together twice. She also was John Voight's girlfriend at that time. And so, you know, early on, I didn't know if I'd ever get to speak to Voight or Hoffman. But so I talked to Jennifer about Voight, what he was like. And she was enormously helpful there. She's also the daughter of Waldo Salt, who was the screenwriter for Midnight Cowboy. So we had a pretty good rapport over that and over her being in this as their first movie. But eventually, in talking about what it was like for her to go to Texas and do some filming, I said, well, how was that? How did it go? And she said, well, it went fine, if you don't mind being raped.
Oh, my God.
And at first I let that go. You know, I thought she was joking around. She's a very funny person, very sardonic, you know, just a wonderful interview. But I came back to it eventually. And she talked about the fact that, you know, not only was she nude for several hours on a steamy hot night in Texas with a guy on top of her. And the guy wasn't doing, you know, was in no way, this was an amateur actor, you know, kid, really. It wasn't him. It just was. It was so unpleasant. And they filmed over and over and over again. And, you know, they had a bodysuit for her, but it was so hot. She, you know, they convinced her to take it off. It just was a kind of situation. And Jennifer was a young woman. We're talking about the New Hollywood era. And New Hollywood era has a lot of great movies, and a lot of great things going on. And you mentioned, you know, Last Tango in Paris. But it was all boys all the time. And Molly Haskell's great book on women in the cinema is about From Reverence to Rape. And the rape part is the late 60s, where suddenly, you know, the walls coming down and the bound, you know, and the chains being unchained, you can do anything. And so what Sam Peckinpah does in Straw Dogs is the biggest rape scene you could possibly do. And he doesn't tell Susan George exactly what he has in mind, or, you know, one or two other, there are a lot of moments.
Maria Schneider said in Last Tango in Paris.
Maria Schneider, exactly. Other moments. And Jennifer is stuck there all night. with this going on around her. Voight's not there because she doesn't want him. She wants to be cooperative. She wants to be the cool girl who does what they want her to do. It's her first movie. It's her dad's screenplay. She wants to do what they want her to do. And yet she was, you know, she was treated brutally by it. And it was really important to get that into the book too. Again, in the idea that capturing the culture of the times and, you know, New Hollywood for all its glories was male dominated, doesn't even begin to, and male fantasies for that matter, even in a movie like MASH. I mean, so many movies where we can look at them now and they're great movies for a lot of reasons, but the way they treat women generally in the storylines is also abominable. Midnight Cowboy, in that sense, a little less so. All the, as I say, all the sex is transactional and all the New Yorkers are predatory, including Sylvia Miles and Brenda Vaccaro and all that. But I thought this part was important in revealing about the context and attitudes about women at that time.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you wrote about it. And I'm also glad to know that it's probably a lot less, happens a lot less now in films, based on what I was reading in the Screen Actors Guild anyway.
I never, you know, when we're talking about Marion Doherty, I just wanted to come back to the fact that there too, Marion did not get a screen credit for Midnight Cowboy because she wanted what was called a single card where her name would be on it alone. And Jerry Hellman, the producer, refused to do that. And both being rather temperamental people, they got into a big argument. And Marion said, well, if you're not going to give me my single card, take my name off the movie. And Jerry did. Jerry told me he regretted it deeply. He thought for sure she'd come back in a few days and they'd work it out, but she never did. And Jerry didn't do anything with it. And so Marion's name isn't on the movie. That's another, you know.
And it's kind of a hypocritical thing too, because the reason, according to your book, that he said he couldn't do it would be because, well, they've already printed the titles and it'd be too expensive. And yet it wasn't so expensive that he couldn't remove her name completely.
You notice that. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And Jerry regrets it. 50 years later, he says it's one of the biggest mistakes he made, because she was so good and so important to the movie. She finally gets a single card title about 5 years later. Hollywood's the place where you have to fight for everything, and getting your name for the great work you do is really important.
Dustin Hoffman and John Voight wanted some piece of the pie when the movie became very successful, and they were denied that.
I don't know if Voight ever really asked. He makes $17,500 for 6 months of work. He certainly deserved more, and I should have asked Jerry about that. that's my fault. I don't know why they didn't think about Voight. Hoffman made good money off the movie. They offered him, I think, 100, you know, 75 or 100, and he got double that in the end, 1,000. You know, this was huge, big money for him. But he'd been very selfless in the sense that he did auditions with all of the potential Joe Buck characters. He put in a lot of effort. And he is, I think, in many ways, one of the main reasons the movie did so well at the box office. You know, you and I both wanted to see Dustin Hoffman.
Right.
And he delivers, and it's fabulous. And I think that drove the lines among young people more than anything else. So it wasn't so outrageous to ask, but they were fed up with him at that point, especially fed up with the fact that he wasn't doing the kind of promotional work they had hoped for. So it wasn't hard for Jerry and John to agree not to give him another dime.
I was just thinking about the scene that I think solidifies his acting in that movie as great. And that's the scene where he has a fantasy that they're on the beach and they're running, and he is running. And of course, Ratso can't walk very well. And yet he's running. And even though he's running, he's still totally in the character of Ratso. From the waist up, he's Ratso. It's such a great scene.
Yeah, I mean, both these guys, you know, they were very well-trained, obsessive New York stage actors. They built those characters from the inside out. They're doing improv together during the rehearsals. Schlesinger's taping some of that and having it put into the screenplay at times. But even after they start shooting, they're eating, when they're eating lunch, they're in character talking to each other. They're coming up with all these ideas for Schlesinger here and there. They drove him and everybody else just slightly crazy because they're both such obsessives. And yet that's how they did it. And it was a collaborative thing. And yeah, Hoffman's fantastic in that scene. And my favorite moment really is toward the end, after when they're supposed to go upstairs to this Andy Warhol style psychedelic party, and Ratso can barely walk and he's all sweaty and they're in the foyer. And Joe takes out his comb to comb Ratso's hair. And then he pulls up his shirt tail to wipe Ratso's sweaty face. And Ratso just puts his left hand on Joe's torso, naked torso, because the shirt tail's up. This isn't in the script. This isn't anything they rehearsed. This is these two guys just doing it. Schlesinger looked at that and he was overwhelmed because it told you things about the characters that the characters themselves didn't even know about the intimacy of their relationship, and that's what it was, that intimacy, which is at the heart of it. And there you see it, just for a second, beautifully done.
It's a very touching moment. Very touching moment. And the thing I love about your new book, Shooting Midnight Cowboy, Art, Sex, Loneliness, Liberation, and the Making of a Dark Classic, Glenn Frankel, is the way you, just as you did with your book about the Searchers and High Noon, is you tell us not just about the film, but about the novel, the writing, the creation of the story, how the story came to the screen, and what happens after. And it's a very rich and wonderfully written book, and thank you for writing it, and congratulations on it. But I want to ask you about one other thing. In your acknowledgments in the end of the book, you mentioned your friend Nick Redman, and I was a big fan of Twilight Time Video. It was a place that you could get unusual films on Blu-ray, and it was a lovely company that's now gone out of business. And your friend was the guy who created that. You want to say a couple things about him?
Yeah, you know, so I come to writing movie books rather late in my rather checkered career. I'd worked for the Washington Post for many years. I got a nice buyout. I left and went up to Stanford, and I wanted to do an American book. I'm sitting out in California. I'm teaching journalism. I've got time. And I decided to do write about the Searchers because it's the movie I'd always loved. It's my favorite Hollywood movie. And I go down to LA. The only problem with doing it is, of course, I know nothing whatsoever about making movies. And what I know is from watching movies. You know, I've seen a lot of movies. It's not like I know nothing, but really, I've never been on a film set. Nick was one of the first people I approached because he had done a documentary on the Searchers, a really good one that you could get when you bought the 50th anniversary DVD. And Nick turns out to be this lovely British guy from Wimbledon, you know, South London. I'd spent 6 years living in London for the Washington Post, so we had a little bit of bonding over that, but mostly we bonded over John Ford and our love of those movies. And he just was so generous and supportive right from the start. He saw what I was trying to do, and he just helped me any way he could. And when I needed to know something about movie music, because he was a specialist in that and really knowledgeable, you know, he helped me find the right people. He got me to John Burlingame at USC, who's a master of movie music. He taught me about temp tracking and about cutting, you know, films to music. All these things, Nick and his wife, Julie Kurgo, you know, who is another film historian and his partner in Twilight, you know, and just, they just really treated me, they adopted me. And I had to build a whole new group of sources and people I could talk to for things to do what I'd done for 27 years at the Washington Post and covering, you know, this and that and so many different things. I was able to bring that to LA, but only because of people like Nick. And Nick was, more than anyone else, Nick and Julie were the ones who really made me feel at home and made me feel I could do this. So Nick died in 2018. I knew I was going to dedicate this book to him. Unfortunately, I ended up having to dedicate it to two other dear friends who died of COVID this past year and who also people who'd helped me over the years. But Nick was just one of those special people that most people don't know about, I suppose, but I couldn't have done any of these books without him.
Well, thank you for talking about him, and thank you for writing this book, Shooting Midnight Cowboy, Art, Sex, Loneliness, Liberation, and the Making of a Dark Classic, the brilliant Glenn Franco. Thank you so much for being our guest again on From the Bookshelf.
Well, Gary, it's great to be back. We'll do it again sometime, okay?
I hope so.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.